It cost Iowa taxpayers some $166 million and houses over 500 of Iowa's most dangerous offenders. This hour, inside the new Iowa State Penitentiary. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Warden Nick Ludwig was my guide for this recent visit to the high-tech maximum security facility. I also had a chance to talk with a number of offenders who are sentenced to life here.
I was happy that I got charged with what I did because I needed to get off the streets. That's real.
What's different about the new Iowa State Penitentiary? We'll take you inside. First, this news. It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And this hour, we're coming to you from Iowa's new state penitentiary in Fort Madison. On August 1st of 2015, it began housing its first inmates. Now, more than 500 of Iowa's most dangerous offenders are found here at this new maximum security prison. It's a prison that cost Iowa taxpayers an estimated $166 million. And this hour, we're going to be accompanying the warden, Warden Nick Ludwig, and tell us how the new prison is different from the old, do some comparison here. Also, what it offers in terms of security, health care, rehabilitation, a lot of aspects of prison life, working in prisons that we want to explore with Warden Nick Ludwig. And he is standing right next to me as we're about to enter the facility. Warden Ludwig, thank you for inviting us here again to see your new facility.
It's always a pleasure to have you visit. We believe very strongly in showing the taxpayers of Iowa our new institution, how well managed, how well organized the new institution is. And it will be a good opportunity again today for you to see firsthand the program opportunities, the work being done by the Iowa Prison Industries, the significant security enhancements, as well as the vibe inside. There's for a maximum security institution, it has a medium security vibe, and that's due in large part to our rapport with the offenders.
Okay, very good. We're right at the entrance to the new facility here. We've gone through some security and about to go through some others, so if you would lead the way, Warden.
Please.
John, how are you?
Good.
If you look to your left, you'll see the captain's office and give you a firsthand look at the new technologies available. You see the giant screen with four different camera locations. Those can all be changed. I have a similar screen in my office. So does our deputy warden, our security director. And that's a significant enhancement by comparison because we have over 400 cameras here, which is a stark contrast to what we had. I can't even recall the number that we had, but it paled in comparison at the previous facility. So we have the ability to see virtually anything and everything that happens inside the institution, be it in a housing unit, food service area, work area, chapel.
As I see the people sitting at the desks, you have the large screen that you you described there with what potentially hundreds of different camera views. If you're sitting there monitoring those cameras, what would be things you're especially looking for, potential red flags that you would want to check out? What sorts of things would you see on camera?
Any rapid movement, any large group gathering. I don't know if I've told you this before, but there are two types of silence in a prison, only one of which is acceptable. A silent day may be a good day. You heard me use the word vibe, a nice pleasant day in the institution. The other is like the calm before a storm when something's going to happen. And the reason I say that is because watching and observing offender behavior, as we do as often as they watch us, it's often easy to determine just through their lack of movement as well. sometimes they'll gather in a certain area. You can watch them looking in a certain area. So the behavior that we have the ability to observe is a key facet of our ability to manage this institution. Mm-hmm.
The enhanced security is certainly a big plus here. You've jumped into the 21st century from, well, some parts of the old institution went back to the 1800s when it was built here. But I wonder if you can tell me how the security, the architecture here, in addition to the cameras, contribute to the enhanced security.
One thing that we employ here is called a unit management system. Unit management basically implies that frequent interaction with smaller groups of people will allow you to reach a desired result. And it does make sense. Give an example. You saw the large four-story high cell blocks at the other institution. These cell houses, or these housing units, as we say, have only two levels. And if you were to look at each one from above, they kind of resemble a starfish. In each one of those buildings, there are four pods. Each pod has an officer. Come on in, Mike. Who also, through architecture and the new design, now has the ability, when looking down his or her respective pod, they're not squared off. They are angled in. So by doing so at the far end, angling in, it allows that officer to observe the front of every cell house. Another thing we have is a significant amount of daylight in each housing unit, especially in our food service area. And we all feel better on a sunny day. You know, so there's no mistake that was taken into account during the design.
Before we pass through the administration here into the actual prison area, many of our listeners will appreciate being reminded how this facility came to be. The old prison, there had been, in its history, prison riots, escapes. Briefly tell us about what happened in the old prison that gave rise to the new one.
The escape of two lifers in 2005 from the fort, as we call it, the prior facility, Iowa State Penitentiary, prompted the legislature and the agency to work on developing a new institution.
Okay, so shall we continue on, Warden?
Yes. How are you? Good. Yourself?
Good. Excuse me, Warden.
Good. Good to see you.
Good to see you, sir.
Okay. We're stepping aside for a moment on this path to the dining hall. A number, dozens and dozens of offenders are on their way to, I suppose, eat lunch or eat breakfast here today. And bright, sunny skies. And as we heard from the warden, eyes on everybody. There are no hidden corners in this new facility. To the right and left of us are poles that go up several hundred feet with lights and cameras on them. Up in the air, watching everything. I'm struck, Warden Ludwig, I'm just struck when I compare this to our last visit here in 2012, the old facility kind of on a hillside up out of the river valley. This is a flatter expanse of land and really open air is what you see here. It's a huge difference. Is that a difference for staff and for the offenders as well?
Oh, definitely. You have to remember, we worked in an environment where our only view was the sky. You know, we were surrounded by those walls. And that is, that's an example of the architecture of the day. Walled facilities were what you would see built in the 1800s, 1900s. This facility, this architectural design is, it points out things that we take for granted. Our individuals now can see traffic. Our individuals can see animals, something they were not allowed to see before, really not capable of seeing before. So that has a very positive impact again.
Warden, as we stand here in the grounds of the new Iowa State Penitentiary, security, of course, the top priority in a prison, especially a maximum security prison like this one. If I am an offender here, planning an escape, trying to escape, What sort of barriers are stopping me? I can see visible barriers in the barbed wire, in the high fence. What are some of the barriers that I might not be able to see here?
Well, the fences are electrified. We have a non-lethal fence on the inside that will deliver up to 7,000 volts. You'll see the tower directly behind me, directly above you. That's one of three towers that we have throughout the institution. We also employ a perimeter vehicle. You can see behind me on the wall, you can see some of the cameras that I previously referenced. But there are also cameras directly above us in these high-mast lights, and cameras virtually in every area of this institution. So at this point in time, we're being watched by a significant number of directions. Many of our guys are used to tours. We'll have a couple that'll probably try to jump on the radio to see if they could do an interview. But
and also, it would be probably interesting for listeners to hear, we are not going to just walk up to any offender, be able to interview them. There are, significant victims' rights issues here involved in interviewing anybody in a prison, right?
That's exactly right. Everyone that we have here has a victim, and we're very mindful of that. So that explains why these interviews are so delicate and why we take the precautions that we do.
If I'm recalling from our last visit here, you have over 500 offenders here. Approximately, if I'm recalling this correctly, approximately two-thirds are here for homicide, for murder?
We have over a half. The number fluctuates, but we definitely have over half of our offenders are serving life sentences.
I guess what strikes me here is, as we see dozens of offenders walk past us, it doesn't seem the security here is not apparent to me. And I know this is just something uneducated eyes looking at the situation, but here you have dozens of offenders out in the open, and we are three individuals just standing here watching them come by.
Well, they're accustomed to tours, but this also lends to the rapport that I mentioned previously that we've established with the individuals. They could come by and be very problematic. One or two probably will be, but this is that. I refer to it as a theory of reciprocity. This is respect. They know that I have company today. They can see me any day of the week, so they're affording us that time to carry on a conversation while a very, very large group of offenders passes by.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Morning.
Radio. Iowa Public Radio, sir. Yes, sir.
But you see what I mean about the vibe here for a maximum security institution? We have our bad days, obviously. You know, I mean, we have critical incidents like other facilities do. But, again, indicative of the sunshine today, it's a beautiful day. They're on their way to food service, which, of course, you know, they're ready to go have lunch, so that probably makes them happy as well. But I'm most impressed by the way that our staff interact with the offenders, and this is true throughout our agency. Our agency places a high emphasis on staff-offender interaction, and that lends to the ability for us to do what we're doing today. I mean, you just had probably 80 offenders walk by you. 80 maximum security offenders walk by without really any inappropriate comments. Things are going as they should. This is a good day in prison. A good day in prison is when no one gets hurt and all of my staff get to go home safely.
How many days are good days compared to bad days, or good days being those without any incidents?
We're shooting for the high 300s. We know things are going to happen. As an administrator, I know that I work in a when environment. It's only a matter of when something happens. It's not a matter of if. So we're judged by how well we prepare for a number of different things that could occur, as well as how well we react to those situations.
If you've just joined us, it's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, visiting Iowa's new state penitentiary in Fort Madison this hour, being given a very nice tour by the warden here. Nick Ludwig has been accompanying us through the facility to show us how it's much different than the old facility, which parts of which dated back to the 1800s, before Iowa was a state.
This is Bertram Burkett. Come on over.
How you doing?
Bertram, if I can call you that, my name is...
They call me Herky.
Herky, they call you Herky. Why do they call you Herky?
That's been my nickname since I was a baby.
Okay, how long have you been here at the Iowa State Penitentiary?
This time about 33 years straight.
Mm-hmm. And you are the barber here.
Yes, sir. I cut everyone's hair, black, white, Mexican, all of them. I do them all, Hispanics, everybody's here.
Is there a standard haircut, or do people get their wishes fulfilled if they can be?
They whatever they come in and ask me for, then I can give it to them.
I saw at the cafeteria a pretty impressive mohawk. Did you do that?
You're talking about Rooster, probably. And yeah, I did that. He's had checkers. He's had ISU number one. He's had all that in his head. He's my main man.
Okay, so now we're in Herky's. We're in your barber shop here. So how many people do you give haircuts to a day?
Usually it's around 12 to 15. Once you get caught up, like when we moved up here and the guys had been locked down and they needed haircuts, one day, for the first 2 days, I cut 30-some heads on each day.
So I imagine, you know, barbers are known for striking up great conversations with their customers. What sort of conversations happen here at a prison barber shop?
I mean, just like on the streets, politics, religion, what happened at the games, who's going to win. You know, I mean, just like you see on the streets, you get all the same conversations right up in there.
Worries about family and friends on the outside?
The barber hears a lot, but you have to keep it to yourself. You know, you don't spread the rumors, and when a guy confides in you, you take that and you keep it to yourself. You dispense the advice that he may be seeking, and after that, that's a done deal.
Your customers here get a good haircut. By the looks of it, when I see around, a creative haircut, if that's what they'd like. But I wonder, what do you get out of this situation here? How does it satisfy you? What's the joy here for you?
Well, I mean, I love cutting hair first and foremost. I like that, and I like doing upholstery work. But my favorite is doing the hospice thing. You know, I get a lot of joy out of helping other people. You know, when I came in, it was a different kind of place. It was a little more dangerous. But there were guys that walked me through. Mm-hmm. Now it's my turn to walk the other young guys through in the right way.
What year did you start serving a sentence at the Iowa State Penitentiary?
1980 was my first. I had a 10-year sentence. Then I got out and I got a life sentence, and I came back in 82.
You said it was a more dangerous place. In what way was it a more dangerous place?
Well, I mean, back then what a prisoner calls a convict calls a penitentiary. You had cold, and guys would get killed, guys would get stabbed or whatever. You know, back then it was a lot more dangerous.
When did you start doing hospice work?
We started the hospice. I was on the first program. We started in 2005. And we had our first patient was a guy that used to work in the gym. I mean, he kept that gym immaculate. And we didn't know he would be the first person. We were still getting ready when Herbie got cancer, and it just evolved from there. We started taking care of him, painted up a room or two, and the hospice program began.
Mm-hmm. So how many hospice patients have you accompanied in their last days of life?
I think I've probably seen about seven of them. But there was one that I didn't really want to see die. His name was Wheeler. When I first met him, I didn't even like him. He came from CCU, and he was mouthy. But then after I got to taking care of him, I mean, he fell with me, fell in love with me, and I fell in love with him. Man way, you know, but he would holler my name, Herky, and the guys would say they calling you. And then it got to the point where if you do this job, you can have 10 people doing the job. But the patient knows who they desire to take care of, and that's who they call.
Facing the end of life is challenging anywhere, but I imagine especially so in prison, where you have much less freedom. You're denied your freedom, your last days. Are wishes of the hospice patients you've had any different than you think hospice people facing the end of life on the outside?
I really honestly believe that everybody that dies in prison desires to be set free. But that's not the reality. You know, so with the hospice program, they get to be treated in a humane way with love, because the guys give them love. And it's a feeling that was never there before, because I used to cut hair back in the hospital before they had the hospice program. And they had the guys dying in a room by itself because the nurse wasn't there doing something for him. But with the hospice, they don't die alone. There's somebody always there. We're praying with them. When they die, we wash them, wash the body, put it in clean sheets. We put it into the bag, and each member of the team gets a zip of the bag. And there's one important thing, and this lady here, she was the instrumental one in the hospice. Her name's Marilyn Sales. And she had a theory, and it was, she meant it. She tell us, she said, when a person dies, they may have came in with ink on their hands. She said, but there better not be a person leave here that has to, after they get fingerprinted, to verify who they are. We wash all that ink off their fingers and get their hands back just like they were. And that's one of the warden's pet peeves, too. He desires that ink be off their hands.
In doing the hospice work here in prison, how has it changed you, Mr. Burkett?
I honestly believe hospice made me a calmer person, a more respectful person. And I believe that everybody that is like 14, 15 years old going to high school should have to do one hospice patient. And I believe if they seen from when they were sick to dying, I don't think you'd have as much shootings, stabbings, disrespect of the youth. I think they would see a different light, because it didn't only enlighten me. The guys that worked it with me, they're changed people. And, you know, you have Glover, Love, Suge, Charlie Watkins, Bobby Smith. These are changed people. They took care of people. I mean, we had one guy, we do ADL work. That's called attention for daily living, where they're not dying, but they can't take care of themselves. And we had a patient that when he came, he was in like a coma. His name was Brian Bandy. And after we took care of him, we got to messing with him, and we found out that if we mess with him, he would get frustrated and try to talk. So we'd get him frustrated, and sure enough, I could kind of figure out what he was trying to say. So the guys around me told me, said, oh, you're crazy. He didn't say that. So I told him, I said, he said he had a sister named Sherry and a brother named Bill. So they had to go look it up. And sure enough, he had a sister named Sherry and a brother named Bill.
Have you contemplated your final days? Will those be likely here within these walls?
Yeah, I mean, I'll probably die in prison. If the court doesn't overturn your case, I mean, everybody that's doing a life sentence is going to die in prison. But I know this. I know that what I put into the program, God will bless me to get it out of it when it's my turn. You know, I don't like putting myself, I'm not above anybody else, but I treat people in the way that I think they'll give me the same treatment.
Mr. Burkett, Herky, if I may,
yes,
thank you for this conversation. You've been very open and enlightening as to what your life is like here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Herky and I probably have the best relationship here. Lacey Kelly may be a close second, some of the other offenders, you know. And like he talked about, bringing younger offenders along, through our interaction and seeing that, he may get some teasing. I may get some teasing. In prison, people will say, oh, you're prisoner friendly. And or in Herky's case, they just say, oh, you're staff friendly. The reality of it is I'm dealing with an individual here that in different circumstances I could deal with on the street.
Coming up in just a moment, my visit to the new Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison continues. I'll talk with Charles, who's serving a life sentence. He's been there for decades. We'll also talk with the warden about what we know as solitary confinement, about gang violence, and about the concern over staffing levels. In fact, an exodus of staff, because the system at the new penitentiary is so radically different. That's when River to River continues. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be back in just a moment. If you've just joined us, it's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Ben Kiefer, not coming to you from our studios, but from Fort Madison, and we're visiting Iowa's new state penitentiary in Fort Madison, which housed its first offenders. The transfer took place in August of 2015, and so we're talking with the warden and some offenders here, as well as some of the correctional officers, to get a feeling for how this facility is different from the old one, how it's changed security, how it's changed a variety of things. Warden Ludwig, recently, because of a hunger strike that began years ago by inmates and a lawsuit in California, the state agreed to cut its use of solitary confinement, where some offenders lived for decades, housed alone in their cells for up to 23 hours a day. Such practices have been in the news. They've drawn criticism from human rights activists who say it's torture, that it's unconstitutional, that it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. I wonder what solitary confinement looks like here at the Iowa State Penitentiary.
You're right about the changes from the past to the present. There's a tremendous focus nationally and especially within our state to ensure that individuals are not left alone for any great period of time. As a matter of fact, there are more moves afoot for programming while in lock status. And it's to address that concern of the negative impact that a tremendous amount of time being in a lock space can lead to mental decompensation, change an individual's mindset. You create more problems than you ever do good by putting someone in a cell and leaving him or her there, locking the door and walking away. We're very mindful of that, and as such, we do things differently throughout the country now than the old days, be it Alcatraz, be it some of the eastern Pennsylvania facilities, the early facilities where an individual was just put in there with a door slammed. You know, I mean, in its cruelest sense, there was no communication. So solitary confinement from days of old to our present system of placing someone in disciplinary detention or administrative segregation, we've talked earlier, and I told you that it may sound like a matter of semantics to some, but it is not. Both clearly stipulate why an individual is housed in a status that is removed from general population, those individuals that we see out walking and talking. And each individual, each case has a clearly stipulated time frame that they will remain in that status. They also know of incentives that will allow them to be removed from that status and return to our sidewalk, return to our general population.
In the California case, which I mentioned, was brought to the attention of the media that solitary confinement was being used as a regular, and it wasn't given a certain amount of time. They were just put in there for an indeterminate amount of time to control gang violence, for instance, in California. Do you have that problem here? Gang violence to control, is that one means of controlling it, what you call lock status?
Every institution in the nation has some form of gang involvement. And the reason I say that is you need to remember when you have gangbangers in society, they get in trouble. Well, guess where they end up? They end up with me and they end up with my colleagues throughout the country. So we have other forms of dealing with them, and I'll give you an indication. Security threat group identification may come in the form of consent on behalf of the offender, one of the initial interviews upon being incarcerated. Yeah, I belong to this group, I belong to that group. There's physical forms of identification in the form of tattoos. And it is very important that we manage the potential tension between groups. Offenders that you've seen walking and talking have gang affiliations. There's a very large amount of guys that we have here that have some form of an affiliation. That doesn't always mean that it's problematic, and many times it's a carryover from the street. It was that group that they ran with. That does not mean that it cannot become very problematic. Whether you have a certain group, maybe difference in geography, maybe difference in ethnicity, it can always cause a problem, and it needs to be managed accordingly.
Staffing has been an issue at this state prison as well as other state prisons. In fact, in years past, and I don't know if this was on your watch, some staff have protested at the inadequate staffing levels. What can you say about that here at this new facility? Do you have an adequate number of staff, personnel, to ensure the security and the safety of your own people and the offenders?
My response would probably be different than my union president and union vice president's response, but when you consider the fact that we have a little over 500 offenders and I have 440 staff, it would be very hard-pressed to find another institution throughout the country that is as well-staffed as we are. There's always room for improving areas of operations and looking at areas where you may put different staff, but with daily monitoring and being flexible when you manage your FTEs, full-time equivalencies, you can do an awful lot with your staff complement, not only to manage this institution, but you remember we have a 200-bed minimum security facility that comprises part of our staffing complement. In answer to your question initially, 440 staff and 500 offenders were doing quite well.
If you've just joined us, it's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today visiting Iowa's new state penitentiary in Fort Madison, housing its first offenders on August 1st of 2015. Now more than 500 of Iowa's most dangerous offenders are found here at this new maximum security prison. And this hour we're getting to know how this new facility works compared to the, you have to say, ancient facility that is also in Fort Madison that is now empty. So we're in C-Pod. This is in, describe where we are, Warden.
We're in C-Pod of Housing Unit 2. C-Pod is one of the four pods, and the offenders that live here are in our second tier. Mm-hmm.
So everything very open. When I compare it to the visit in 2012 to the fort, everything was closed. Your officers were behind protective walls or plexiglass. Here I see an officer right to the left of us at a computer. He's just got a computer terminal, no protection around him. Is this a different philosophy?
It is definitely a different philosophy. This is that unit management concept. Not only is it a very well-lit, obviously clean, brand-new institution, but you see the design allows this officer, Mr. Jackson, to see all the way to the end of the facility, as opposed to the old builds would be rectangular. Mm-hmm. This slanted design where the far end is much thinner than the front of the institution, of the pod.
Triangular.
Yes. Allows him the opportunity to see the front of every door. And with the smaller numbers, I expect my staff to know every offender here.
Now this is such a change for the staff. I wonder if all your staff from the old facility was comfortable being in such different conditions where they're out in the open, they're expected to interact with the offenders to create the vibe that you've been talking about. Were all of them comfortable with that?
No, not at all. Not at all. As a matter of fact, it resulted in quite a mass exodus of my most senior staff who were eligible to retire. But they would not subscribe to the expectation, the theory that we need the enhanced communication, the familiarity with offenders, the walk and talk. They'd grown up with the system of sitting in an enclosure, banging on a window, telling somebody to hit your door. Here, there's nothing that prohibits the offender from walking right up to this officer. The officer now is doing work on his computer. Majority of the time, he'll be out making rounds. What do you got there? PDA, right? Okay. That allows him to be able to be a mobile officer where he can walk around and do many of the same features that he can on his computer.
We're in a pod of Building 2 at the new Iowa State Penitentiary, and one of the residents here, one of the offenders, has invited us into his cell, his home here. Charles, pleased to meet you. Ben Kiefer, Iowa Public Radio.
Good to meet you, too. Good to meet you.
Well, thank you very much.
Sit down?
Oh, sure. Thank you. I'll take a little seat on your corner of your bed. Okay. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How long have you, of course, you've only been in this facility for a couple months.
Yes, sir.
How long have you been at the Iowa State Penitentiary? What year did you come in?
75. Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. Tell us a little bit about how life here is different from the fort.
Whole lot different. Number one, it's cleaner. That's the great thing. It's a clean place. The old place been there for 300 years. It's, you know, and it was just really good to get out of that type of environment. We got rooms now instead of a cell. It gives you more privacy. It's more modern. The old place was just falling apart.
I see the cell that you have here is, I don't know, 12 foot long by maybe 6-8 foot wide, high ceiling here, well lighted, and you've got your sink, you've got your toilet, you've got a TV here, and this is a place where you spend how many hours a day?
I work in the unit, so I spend quite a few hours in. I like to read and do a lot of studying, so I usually spend probably about 10 hours in.
You're a lifer. You're going to be here until the end of your life.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm wondering, how long did it take you to accept that? Was that within the first few years? Because that's what a lot of the majority of the population here faces, is life imprisonment.
Yeah, it took me about 12, 13 years for it to really sink in.
When you talk about coping with it or having it sink in, what does that mean? What changed in your thinking to be able to cope with life here and have some satisfaction in life and live the rest of your life here?
It changes for me what it did. It changed my thinking to the point where everything is more of a reality now than it was back then. Because back then it wasn't really a reality, because you always had the idea that you're going to get out quick, you're going to go back and live your life. Now you know that you're not going to get out. You're not going to live your life the way that you used to. So now I became more focused on family. I became focused on myself as a person and an individual. How do I deal with people nowadays compared to how I used to deal with people then? All of that changed to more positive than it used to be. It used to be more negative then, but now it's more positive because you see things in a different light. You begin to become a better person. You learn how to treat people differently. You learn back to the things that your mother taught you when you was young that you didn't pay no attention to, but now you really see that there was nothing but value and knowledge there.
I don't know your specific crime. I do know you're here for life. How much thought do you have, how much time do you spend thinking about the victim of your crime and the victim's family?
I have a great deal of remorse for what I did, because it was hard for me to really see that, because I was in Vietnam. And being a Vietnam veteran, I became hardened to death. You know, it was all around me all the time. So after I was here for a long time and my mother and certain members of my family passed away, emotionally outside, it wasn't there because everything was held inside. So for the victims of the family that I caused this tragedy in their lives, I see it in a whole different light. And I have a lot of remorse. I have a lot. I hope they can sometime, one day, will be able to forgive me for the hurt and the harm that I brought to them and their families. And even if they don't, I really look at it as I was happy that I got charged with what I did, because I needed to get off the streets. That's real. I needed to be off because I was involved in a lot of things that was not for the growth of myself, for the community, or anyone else. It was all destructive. So I'm glad I came back, because it gave me a chance to come into myself, see my true self, which I know was not really the things that I did. So I'm really grateful.
Charles, I want to thank you for inviting us into your home here at the State Penitentiary and sharing your thoughts with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the time, and y'all have a good journey.
He ran me down on the yard one time, and he said, "Hey, I know you're a 4-star general, but I'm a 5-star general now."
Okay. Pleased to meet you, sir. I'm Ben Kiefer of Iowa Public Radio.
Okay, glad to meet you too.
You've been here at the penitentiary how long?
Oh, probably about 20-some years, going on 30 years.
How much of a difference does a new facility like this make to living and working here?
It's a lot better. I mean, I miss the old place, but we have to move on, I guess, so we're doing all right.
Really? You miss the old place? What would you miss about the old place?
Well, probably the rabbits, the animals, the flowers, and all the birds we used to feed over there. And we don't feed them here because we got pelicans flying around, so we don't do that no more. We are going to put a birdhouse up this next spring.
I don't know if those are pelicans, Art.
Well, I don't know what they are, but they seem kind of big. But I work in the chapel, the same place I did over there.
What do you do in the chapel now?
Oh, I clean and cut papers up.
Recycling. He'll cut up a lot of our cardboard boxes and things of that nature. So he does that type of work, keeps a very clean shop, takes a lot of pride in his work.
Well, nice to run into you today, Art.
Glad to meet all you, too.
My name's Derek Smith. I've been here since 1999. I've got 21 years in almost on a life sentence.
And we're in a new part of your facility here, a music room. There's all kinds of guitars, acoustic and electric. What's going on here? You're in charge of this.
Well, technically, I'm not in charge, but I've been assigned to make sure that the equipment stays in tune or to make sure that it's in good repair, that all the inmates who have access to the program know how to utilize the equipment properly.
What is having a room like this and more access to music and guitars done for your life here? How has it changed it?
Where you wouldn't necessarily communicate or have social interactions with certain people, it brings us together to where I may have not never had the opportunity to, you know, even have a conversation with certain people. Now they're interested in the music program, and because this is important to all of us to varying degrees, we come together and we make those connections. And, you know, there might be issues. This is a penitentiary, you know, and we're not always going to get along all the time. And sometimes issues arise. But it seems like in here, all those things get checked at the door. If you know, you can come in here and you can decompress. If you had a bad day on the yard, you can come in here and pick a guitar up and you can lose yourself in the music.
Derek Smith, thanks a lot for explaining what you've been doing here today.
Good to meet you.
Good to meet you. Thanks.
Warden Ludwig, I've noticed in our tour thus far, passing offenders in various situations, that greetings are common between you and the offenders, of course, between you and your staff as well. How well do the offenders know you, know about you, your personal life, or is that something you keep at a distance?
The offenders know me very well. As we traverse this institution, you'll hear offenders say, you know, how you doing? You know, I'm praying for you. They're praying for me because they know that I have cancer. They know that I have cancer because I'm open with people about dealing with adversity. As a matter of fact, I've used it when speaking with offender populations. And I did a speech about dealing with adversity. Dealing with time. I said, I'm also doing time. You guys are doing time in a different increment by a sentence. Mine is unknown as yours is unknown. And there's a risk when you do that. There's a risk of stepping over that familiarity bound. But I still draw the line. You know, I don't share any more information than that with them, but it also speaks to the fact that I'm dealing with a community of individuals. You just saw me stop an individual by calling his name with his back turned to us, probably 2 football fields away. That speaks to the familiarity, the frequency of being accessible. One of the key facets for any warden and any administrator in corrections is to be accessible. And the more accessible you are, the more involvement you have both with staff and offenders, and then that creates this atmosphere that we're enjoying today.
Warden Ludwick, it's been an eye-opening experience. I have to say, this tour, and I think I speak for many of the listeners, has exploded many of the myths that people have about a maximum security facility. Watching here, we've seen well over 100, maybe a couple hundred offenders here, been walking next to them in many cases, talking to three, four, five of them to find out their perspective on this, and a great deal of respect here that I know you cultivate here, doors being held open, people saying, excuse me. These are things that we do not connect with a maximum security facility, and I want to thank you today for showing us around.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I look forward to the next visit. I'm glad you had the opportunity to see firsthand that there is a different way to run an institution and that you can teach people manners despite the security level they happen to be in. And it all starts with my staff. You know, just the willingness to walk and talk. We are dealing with people. Many of them will be with us the rest of their life. So this is our community, and I just happen to be responsible for this community.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I want to remind you that for this special edition of River to River, go to our website to find plenty of photos of the new Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison. It's really quite an experience to see the images as well and to contrast it with what may be images in your mind about what a maximum security prison should look like. Go to iowapublicradio.org and make sure you drop us a line. You can drop us an email. Contact us through the website as well. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.